Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, March 10th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We are firmly in the middle of fall spring right now in the Delaware Valley. You're enjoying it, I assume.
Yes, I am.
70 whatever degrees it is. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're in the car, blast the music, roll the windows down. That's all good.
Mm-hmm.
What's not good is how much you probably pay for that car.
A lot.
Cha-ching. Mm-hmm. Whether it's new or used. New cars in this country, Cherry, the average one sells for over $50,000. The cost of cars has gone up in recent years, like many commodities. But today we want to dig into why specifically the cost of cars has increased so much in this country. There's a lot of factors at play. Consumer preferences, the behavior of the automakers, the fact that we haven't developed cheap EVs like some other countries out there, China. So we're going to dig in today with a couple of great reporters who cover the auto industry, and we would love to hear from you. Tell us about your recent experience buying a car. What factored into your decision? Was it hella expensive? 888-477-9499 is the number to call. The email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, this is another perfect time for our callers to call in. You know, if you bought
it's
a car 20
a
years ago
time.
And now it was totally different. Maybe you were shocked at how much things have changed. Give us a call, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
If you got a really cheap car, you just want to brag about it.
Let us know too? What deals did you get and where did you go? Let us know.
China. The answer is China. They went to China.
So we do have to start out with some breaking news.
Yeah, we have some breaking news before we get into our trio of local news stories. We are aware that firefighters are battling a massive blaze that erupted on a scrap metal barge that's in the Delaware River right now. Mm-hmm. This is from our news partner 6ABC. We don't have a lot of updates right now. Of course, we hope that this is resolved. It looks like a very scary and dangerous situation, but wanted to alert you there is a fire on that scrap metal barge in the Delaware River. If you're smelling smoke, that might be what you are smelling, by the way. Updates to come on that throughout the afternoon. Go ahead, Cherry, now to our first local headline of the day.
Yes, and you may have heard that the Department of Justice settled its antitrust case against Ticketmaster and its parent company, Live Nation. But apparently that case is not over. Pennsylvania and New Jersey are among the states that have rejected the deal and want to go to trial. If you recall, Live Nation is accused of squashing all competition in the live music industry and driving up prices for fans by controlling virtually every aspect of the live performance, from artist management to venues to ticketing. And under this tentative DOJ deal that they signed on Thursday, Live Nation would pay about $280 million in fines. It would divest itself from at least 13 amphitheaters nationwide. It would also allow promoters to divvy up sales for 50% of tickets so that competitors like SeatGeek and others could get in on the ticket action. It would also cap fees at 15% of ticket price. 10 states signed on to this agreement, but more than two dozen states rejected the deal. In addition to New Jersey and Pennsylvania, states that want that trial include California, New York, Maryland, North Carolina, and Illinois, to name a few. New York Attorney General Letitia James said that the DOJ deal failed to address the monopoly at the center of the case. Others have said, look, $280 million fine, too low. Live Nation makes that in about 4 days of revenue. So they're like, this does not protect fans. This does not protect artists. It does not protect independent theaters. Not enough is being done here.
Yeah, and from what I read of the reporting, it seems like maybe there's also a tension here about how the federal government worked or did not work with the states in coming to this resolution. A lot of folks were saying things like, we were surprised, or
the judge was surprised.
The judge was even surprised about the settlement. So that's always going to piss off your partners if you come to agreement and they're like, wait, why did you shut us out of that room? So you don't know how much that's factoring into the decision to continue on, but that might be a sort of a subplot. To what's happening here between the states and the federal government.
And so if nobody comes to the table, if they don't work this out, the trial's going to resume next week.
Yeah,
so there you go.
Story number two. This is so fascinating to me. So there's a new planned community coming to South Jersey. Actually, I always find planned communities to be fascinating for whatever reason. Maybe it's just the utopian nature of them, or the attempted utopian nature. But anyways, this planned community, what's notable about it is that it's being built by Rowan University. The South Jersey Higher Education Institution unveiled plans to build what it's calling a wellness village about a mile west of its main campus in Glassboro. Mm-hmm. Now, you're thinking academic buildings, wellness right? Village. But you would be wrong. This village is not all that academic at all. It's just a place for people to live. It includes an assisted living facility, some retail spaces, market rate housing, even a wooded preserve with walking trails, and a hotel.
Wow.
In the wellness village. You can stay in the wellness village. I don't know what the nightly rate is. But and then next to this wellness village, next door, there's going to be something called the Rowan University Center for Manufacturing Innovation, which sounds kind of like an office park had a marriage with a research facility. But anyways, what?
That was cute. They got
marriage? Yeah. Well, I love love. Anyways, so in combination, this wellness village and manufacturing research district are being called the Rowan West Campus. The price tag, $690 million. This will take many years to complete, but they're starting to at least begin the process of building this thing out.
So interesting, and it's kind of strange, but according to the Business Journal, they have big dreams. They want this West Campus project. It's aimed at making Rowan more than just a regional player.
Yeah.
You know, they want the school to draw students from all across the country, and they want to grow, their student body to like 100,000 students in the future.
100,000?
With online school as well. So probably
more than a village for 100,000 students.
But we laughed about this in our meeting earlier because it was unclear how the students would be connected to this.
Yeah.
I think they said they would have some internships over at the village.
Yeah.
Maybe some jobs, but it was just strange. Like, well, how is this benefiting the students necessarily?
I'm so intrigued, but I'm also so confused. Hopefully it comes to fruition. We get to see how it works.
Yeah.
The idea of a university building a little village, like a model village.
Mm-hmm.
How fascinating.
Well, universities have been innovating in this space, and there's a need for housing. So why shouldn't universities get into that space?
That's true. And on some level, like, higher education has always been the development business.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, this example is so striking to me. So anyways, we'll be watching the Rowan University Wellness Village.
Wellness. And we're putting up the little quotey.
Oh, you're putting the air quotes? Are you a skeptic?
Wellness village.
Because you're a skeptic?
Not because I'm a... But it's like...
You don't get it.
I don't get it. It's like a branding marketing term. Like, I don't know what that is.
I think it's supposed to be based on some of the concepts of these blue zones out there. Do you know the blue zones where, like, people live for a long time, these parts of the world? So it's supposed to be, like, oriented around health and wellness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. A bit of a hater there. Okay. I wasn't expecting that. Go ahead. All right. Third story.
So here's what may be the most surprisingly wholesome, Philly yet very un-Philly porch pirate intervention of all time. The incident was caught on a Ring camera in South Philly. It shows a woman walking down the street and all of a sudden decide to snatch a package off of a porch, and bam, she gets caught red-handed by a grandma from across the way. Take a listen.
What you doing? Put that back. Put it back. Put it right back. And going down the street. Go ahead. Stop stealing people's packages. I'll give you some money. Here's $7. Here's $7. Okay? Here's $7. You better than that.
Okay, so as you...
A
lot happened back to back there. The woman startled threw the package down. She scurries away. But then, of course, you heard the grandma sort of call her back, gives her money, tells her to get some help, that she's better than that. And the thing I love about this that you found on Reddit, by the way, Avi, is that it shows the two-sided nature of the Philadelphia psyche. You know, right. We will lay you out and then we will love you up.
Yeah, come on back. Come on back. You can do better than that. I love that. By the way, a guy named Mr. Allen 77 found this clip and posted it on Philadelphia subreddit. So shout out to that particular user.
So what drew you to this, though? Because you love this. You were giggling about this.
I love it. I mean, exactly like you said, the two-sided nature, the sort of the Philliness in both directions. But also, I was just like, you know, everyone talks about, like, AI security these days. Mm-hmm. But before AI security, there was AICU.
Yes.
And that's the original AI security.
AICU.
AICU. Zuckerberg, Musk have never developed anything better than AICU. AICU works 100% of the time.
I know, that's right.
Also, on a more serious note, the other thing that struck me is that we've all had our interactions with porch pirates in Philadelphia. And you get so mad and like, you could tell from this video, or I think you can kind of infer, like a lot of the people that are doing this, they're desperate. You know what I mean? And like, if you maybe help them out a little bit or maybe just show some love, maybe you could be like a little spark in their life. And I don't know what's going to happen to this person who is trying to steal the package, but it did remind me like to check myself when I get mad, because I've had that interaction or I've had that experience, lose a package and you're like, man, these people suck. But a lot of people in that situation are truly like, out of options. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you gave him $7, gave him $5, you might.
And she showed a little love. Shout out to Grandma.
We don't know who she is. I would love if this sparked someone tracking her down.
Yeah.
Because I tried to look around a little bit. I couldn't find. I don't know who she is.
Yeah.
But I already love her. She reminds me of every block captain you've ever met in your life.
Hugs. Love that. We needed a little joy for this morning. And so we're going to be talking about cars because.
No joy there.
No joy there. Yeah, we'll be right back after the
break.
Too
expensive, y'all. AICU.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. U.S. gas prices have surged since the onset of the war in Iran, and pain at the pump is just one of the many paper cuts felt by American drivers today. The average cost of a new car is a whopping $50,000, and the cost of owning a car, maintenance, insurance, registration, etc., has risen over 40% since 2020.
So what accounts for this affordability crisis? And if fewer and fewer Americans can afford new cars, why do car manufacturers keep churning out bigger, more expensive models? To help us unpack all of this, we have a pair of great journalists. Jessica Caldwell is head of insights at Edmunds. Jessica, thanks for being here.
Thank you guys for having me.
And let me also welcome in Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at The Verge. Thanks for verging our way today, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, our questions of the day are for you to tell us about your recent experience buying a car and what factored into that decision. You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the chat. Love to hear from you, especially if you just came into the game after years and you saw the big difference. Love to hear from you.
Let's start with this comment from Matt, who says, it's important to remember that what cars are produced are not what all Americans want. They are what the new car buyers want. That's a very specific demographic. Most cars are sold used to people who can't afford new vehicles. Small, fuel-efficient cars aren't available to them because new buyers don't buy them. So we're going to try to unpack why cars are so expensive. And let's start there, Jessica. Does it come down to the preferences of the types of people who buy new cars? Is that the main driver, or would you say it's secondary? Help us start there, Jessica.
I mean, it really is, just because when you think about it, people ultimately have to purchase these vehicles. And the situation we're in is quite telling if we look back in history, because if you remember, in 2008, we had a significant gas price spike. And a big criticism, and at the same time, the American OEMs, they were teetering on bankruptcy. And the thought was, oh, the reason why they're going bankrupt is because they don't make these fuel efficient vehicles that Americans now want. We have to go buy imports. And then they started to afterwards, and they made these smaller compact cars, subcompact cars, and then the economy improved, and nobody actually wanted those cars. Everyone wanted the big SUVs and trucks, and as a result, they had to shutter those smaller car lines. So what we're seeing today is a lineup that was largely determined by people through the 2010s, because times were good, interest rates were low, so they wanted larger vehicles, more technology, more creature comforts. And that's how you see today transaction prices be so high because we essentially demanded all those things. Well, I should say that it was a good point. New car buyers demanded all those things.
Yeah, that's the part I wanted to get into. New car buyers mm-hmm. versus the general car driving public. Like, is there a split there, Andrew, in like who is buying the new cars and what sort of the rest of the Americans want? Or are they more or less in lockstep?
Yeah, I think there definitely is a split. I think what you're seeing is that a lot of the high price segments, like in the $70,000 to $80,000 range, are still selling relatively well, whereas we're seeing not as much available in the lower range, below $40,000, for example. You know, those listings have been shrinking over the last year or so. Whereas it seems like the luxury market is still doing fairly well. So I do think that there is like a lot of segmenting going on in the market.
Yeah. And quick follow up, Andrew, I mean, what kind of goes into this pricing structure? Because, you know, it just feels like, I mean, I got my first car in high school and it cost a few $1,000s, brand new Hyundai Excel, was purple. And I think about that. And I think about
that. Did it have a name?
Hyundai Excel.
No, you have your car name.
I did not have a name.
Like Big Purple.
I did have a car a name for my car. But it was like it was less than $7,000. And so I think about car prices now, you know, it didn't have, you know, it had a crank window, all of those things. But I'm just wondering, like, what is making the cars cost so much? What is sort of has sort of shifted it and driven up the price?
Well, I think first of all, we need more purple cars. I tip my hat to you for owning a purple car. That's amazing. But I do think, you know, sort of building on what Jessica was saying, you know, a lot of the cars, modern cars, new cars that are coming out today are just essentially really high tech computers on wheels. There's a lot of technology that's going into these vehicles, whether it's, you know, through like the AV infotainment system, whether it's advanced driver assist systems, a lot of cameras and sensors. And I think that all of that just sort of adds up over time. And so I think people, you know, they're not just buying the car, they're also buying sort of like all of the technology and the compute that goes along with it. And that can make a car a lot safer than cars in the past, but it can also obviously lead to a spike in sticker prices.
But why doesn't someone come in and undercut that? That's how markets are supposed to work. Like, I don't care about that. I mean, honest, I truly do not care about this. I like the backup camera, I'll be honest there. But everything
helpful.
Else, I really don't care. I just want to get from A to B. I feel like there's got to be other consumers out there like me. Maybe there aren't, Jessica. Maybe just like Americans want all these bells and whistles and they're willing to devote an ever-growing portion of their family budget to get all this stuff. I mean, walk me through that, Jessica.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you go into, how old is your car, Avi?
It's a used. We haven't had it this entire time, but it's a 2008 Toyota Prius, so it's almost 20 years old. And it, by the way, runs amazing, which is another reason. Like, I don't get why people invest all this money in these new cars, these old cars. It's amazing how they hold up. But anyways, go ahead.
Well, I think if you went to a car dealership and you sat in a 2026 model year and compared it to your 2008 Prius, I feel like the emotion will get to you. All of a sudden, you will see all the features that you have never seen before and that make your life so much nicer and better. Because at the end of the day, car buying is a really emotional purchase, and that's where they get you. They get you in that vehicle, that new vehicle, and all of a sudden, you are treated to all these new amenities that you haven't before. And that's why people are making these decisions, because all of a sudden, they never knew about, you know, other technology features, and they didn't really care. They thought, I'm going from point A to point B, and then they experience them. And then that's what happens. And
but
then
has to be a breaking point, right? Because there's some stats about how there's a growing percentage of people who are severely delinquent on their auto loans. It reached 8.6% last year, according to the Philly Fed. That's the highest level since 2020. And that was only a brief period and really the highest level since 2008-2009. So at some point, you would have to be charging people too much and there would have to be a backlash reaction. Is it just we haven't reached that yet, Jessica? Is it coming? Or is the appetite just so great for these new cars that it'll go on forever?
Yeah, I mean, the appetite is real. At the end of the day, like, no one's forcing you to buy a new car. Like, no one's forcing you to buy a $50,000 car. You could go buy yourself an $8,000 car. Granted, there's not a lot of those around that
I was
reliable
about to say.
However, no one's forcing you into this car purchase. So I think people just, they get in over their heads, essentially.
Yeah.
They think, okay, I'm going to extend these loan terms to what, 7 years, in some cases, 8 years. I'm just going to try my best and see what happens. And that's sort of how you get like wrapped up into all of these things. And you end up not being able to make your payment. But, and I do think that there is a divide in the market. People that want to, like Andrew had said, buy more expensive vehicles. The amount of time that a vehicle over $70,000 stays on the lot is the same exact amount of time that a vehicle under $70,000 stays on the lot. So they're selling at the same rate, essentially. So you have these vehicles being snapped up quickly. So, it really kind of just, I think, shows that K-shaped divide in the economy of people that are high income, just kind of carrying on like nothing's really changed. And then folks that are struggling on the lower end and are looking for affordable options and, potentially used car options that they can afford.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, you could join the conversation. Tell us about your recent experience buying a car, what factored into that decision. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube and Facebook, you can put your comments in the chat. Let's bring in a caller. We have Caroline from Avalon on the line. Caroline, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, well, first of all, shout out to the 20-year-old Prius.
yes.
I am probably driving as we speak right now, like, I don't know, a 9-year-old Chevy Traverse, which I love. But I went new car checking out recently. And honestly, the amount of technology, and like you'd go 2 feet and like 6 alarms went off. And like I was having a seizure trying to drive it because every 2 feet, like a different alarm was going off. I was like, all I need is that backup camera and like a quiet car. And I drove 3 cars and all 3 of them were so stressful. And I'm like in my mid 40s, I'm not like 100. And I just couldn't, I couldn't believe how overdone and how stressful they were. And I was like, I like a nice car, but like, this is at this point after shopping, I'm going to drive this Traverse into the ground because there's nothing out there. I want more.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Caroline from Avalon. Team,
she's a woman after my own heart.
She's like too much tech. And I can totally understand Caroline. Great caller, by the way. Are the cars better? Like I admit that, my Hyundai Excel wasn't the best. If you went up a mountain or a hill, you couldn't have the air conditioning on at the same time. So I wonder, like, are we at a place that even if, you're paying all this money for these cars tend to last longer. They're just higher quality. Are people getting the bang for the buck, Jessica?
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing about this market is that, yes, car prices have gone up about 30% since pre-COVID. So many factors here. but the thing is, you are getting a better product. It's not like a gallon of milk or clothes where it's like exactly the same thing, but you're paying, 30, 50% more than what you paid before. So at least in the car market, you are getting a vehicle with better technology. Some people may find it annoying. I think when you live with it a while, it definitely gets better. You can turn a lot of those functions off, though, by the way, if they really annoy you. Mm-hmm. But you're getting essentially a better quality, better amenities, better features. And I mean, when you drive a new car, it is, and a lot of times better fuel efficiency too. I mean, fuel efficiency has also gone up. So it's like you're getting a better product. Unlike, it feels like everything else in our life where it's exactly the same, just more pricey. Mm.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And Andrew, I wanted to ask you, I mean, because it seems like the cars, if you pay $50,000 for a car, but it lasts you 20 years, you could argue that maybe you're getting, your bang for your buck. Your thoughts about that and just sort of how, we have changed how we shop, because there's a couple people who wrote in on Facebook who said that they lease all the time. And and so they're constantly getting new cars every few years. I just wonder how we have sort of shifted even how we look at cars and are sort of getting around these extremely high prices.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the sticker price is one thing to focus on. But as you own a vehicle, there's obviously the cost of maintaining that vehicle, any repairs that you might need over time. And so you want to factor that in as well. And I think Jessica's absolutely right. Not only are their cars better in terms of fuel efficiency, they are obviously getting a lot better in terms of maintenance and repair over time as well. I think especially in the electric vehicle market, that's one of the big selling points for electric vehicles, mm-hmm. even though sort of like policy has changed and demand seems to be slowing down significantly. The cars electric vehicles do require far less maintenance over time. You don't have to go in for an oil change. You don't have to, get, like a lot of these other things that you would with a nice vehicle. So I do think that there are some selling points, but it is absolutely true that the affordability is really hitting people at a time when they can least afford it. And it's causing them to really hold on to some of their older vehicles, which have worse fuel efficiency, require a lot more maintenance over time. And so will end up costing them down the road as compared to perhaps a newer vehicle with less of those problems.
Yeah. Keep those calls and comments coming, by the way. 888-477-9499. Studio2@WHYY.org is the email. We want to hear about your car purchasing experiences. Victor says, we recently went shopping for used mm-hmm. cars, and OMG, mm. what you get for the prices, just no. I want to read a stat here we got from Deloitte. So sales of small and compact cars in America have dropped from 2.1 million in 2010 to 1.7 million last year. Meanwhile, sales of small and compact SUVs rose from 1.5 million in 2010 to 5.4 million in 2025. Andrew, help me understand the seemingly insatiable appetite for larger vehicles among the American population. And we should point out, this is at a time when the American family is actually getting smaller. So it's a little hard to understand why people feel the need for bigger cars and more space. And yet, it's right there in the data. So what's going on, and how is that impacting the price of everything, Andrew?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. It's absolutely true that our tastes in vehicles have grown, you know, sort of literally over the years. And I think that that's due to a number of factors. The automakers are pushing larger vehicles on customers. These are higher profit margin vehicles for the most part. So they end up making more money on the sale of these vehicles in the long term. And then I think it's clear that customers are want these cars, right? They like being higher up, being able to see more of the road as you would in a truck or an SUV as compared to a sedan. And American car manufacturers are basically out of the sedan business, right? They have stopped making small cars. You know, Ford, GM have largely discontinued most of their small vehicles and have shifted instead over to the crossover. Either the compact SUV or midsize SUV space is where you're seeing a lot of the growth in demands these days. So it's a number of factors. It's demand, it's higher profit margins. This obviously has a lot to do with sort of the safety crisis that we're seeing out on our roads today, too. Yeah. With more pedestrians being struck and killed by cars. I think a lot of that is due to the fact that most people are struggling to handle the size of their vehicle. So I think that there's a lot of sort of intersecting trends that are sort of colliding here.
Mm. Yeah. Craig says, we've always bought used cars with good service records and brand loyalty, but never paid more than $8,000. The caveat, expect upkeep to set you back $2,500 per year, but the upside is not having to part with a lot of upfront cash. Huh. I wonder what the used market looks like for people hoping to find some relief. If you're like, look, $50,000, too much. But, you know, maybe I can get something used that's more reasonable. Jessica, what does that look like for folks? Or are used cars pretty expensive as well, if you want something good quality?
Yeah, I mean, it's the entire market is expensive. But what's going on here, too, that we probably should mention is that to have a used car, you have to have a new car. And when you look at the sales from COVID on, there were years in which there were not a lot of new vehicles sold, particularly in 2002. There was a chip shortage. You probably remember that. Yep. And not a lot of vehicles were leased, not a lot of vehicles were sold. And so when we look at 2025, to someone who had commented earlier saying, oh, I just went used car shopping and the prices are crazy. Well, it's true because there's no vehicles coming off of lease. There weren't a lot of like daily rental, like Hertz vehicles purchased because they just weren't available. So anyone that's shopping sort of that near new used vehicles thinking, I'm going to go to the used market because I don't want to pay the new vehicle prices. There's just not a lot to choose from. And when that happens, prices go up. And then when we look at the older years, so 5 years, 7 years, those prices go up too, because that's where these people that would normally have bought like a 3-year off lease, maybe a certified pre-owned vehicle would buy. And they're, you know, and because the demand has spiked there, those prices go up. So there's not really a lot of relief in any age that you buy a vehicle. It will be a little bit better in 2026 because we will see more lease returns, particularly for electrified vehicles. So those folks that have been shopping and turned off by what's available, may look a little better this year. So I would say keep trying to find that car, but it is inherently tough right now. Mm.
Timing matters.
Yeah. Yeah, we're coming up on a break. Let me read in a couple more comments. John says vehicles are no longer solely for transportation mm-hmm. and are now status symbols used as reflections of our personalities for everyone else to see. Kathy says, I recently bought a new car hybrid Camry. There were none available in the model I wanted. I had to put a deposit for one in production, but still couldn't pick features. All come with different packages and no choice to add or remove any. Packages add a lot of money to the price. There was no negotiation. In the past, I've always been able to get a better price. So Kathy feeling some frustration. On the other side of this break, we're going to talk a little bit more about the affordability crisis with cars. We're also going to talk a little about EVs, mm-hmm. which in some markets is starting to relieve the cost, but not in this market. Mm. We're going to explain why. Yeah. Keep those calls and comments coming, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We've been talking this hour about the affordability crisis facing American drivers and the future of the American car industry.
Let me reintroduce our guests. We have Jessica Caldwell, automotive journalist at Edmunds, and Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at the Verge. And our question for you, our listeners, is tell us about your recent experience buying a car. What factored into that decision? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube and Facebook, put your comments in the chat.
Let's bring in a caller. Here's John from Philly on the line. John, tell us about your car preferences, your car buying experience. What do you got for us, John?
Hi. Yeah, I drive a 2014 smart car, live in the city, and I do not understand why people pay up for these new cars. I do rent cars when I'm traveling for work, and you had an earlier caller talking about the all the bells and whistles in it. It's incredibly annoying. my smart car is great. And
how much did you pay for that, John? Because I wonder,
Sure, I bought it used for $6,000.
All right.
Ooh, baby.
John, that's a good deal. That's
good for
not
you,
bad, John.
It's great. Unfortunately, Mercedes doesn't sell them anymore in the U.S. because too few Americans buy them. They're all over Europe, though.
Yep.
They're in all the cities in Europe because they used to park them.
Yep, absolutely. Well, they're a great car to have in South Philly.
6K.
I know that, talking about parking.
Not bad.
Thanks, John. Let's bring in another caller here. This is Jordan from Philly, also mm-hmm. on the line. Hey, Jordan, you're on Studio 2. What would you want to add to the conversation today?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's either comment, question as well. I just want to expand on what Avi said about, I think there is a market out there for people who want to simplify their lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, with like, there's an expanded market for cell phones, you know, dumb phones. People are going back to analog film cameras. People that just want to get from A to B. I know that China has, you know, a cheaper, you know, less expensive version of an EV. Why aren't the American car makers going in that direction as well?
Great question, Jordan.
Is tipping us off to the next part of the convo. Thank you, Jordan.
So let's get some stats in here. So in the U.S., according to some great reporting by a guy named Andrew Hawkins at The Verge. So in the U.S., EV sales, new cars, among new cars sold, about 10% are EVs. Compare that to Norway, 96%, Sweden, 65%, Denmark, 68%, China, 50% of new auto sales are electric vehicles. So how do we get here, Andrew? Why did the U.S. fall behind in terms of EV sales?
Yeah, there's a number of different reasons that you could address, but I think mostly I sort of think of it in two ways, right? The automakers kind of whiffed the problem. They didn't attack it as seriously as they should have, knowing that China was sort of coming for them in a really major way. And this is both the American automakers and the European automakers, I would say. And then also the, I think the policy swing that we've just experienced over the last year with the Trump administration essentially eliminating all of the incentives that were on the books to encourage more people to buy electric vehicles, but also to encourage domestic manufacturing of electric vehicles, battery manufacturing, et cetera. So I think the combination of these two things, both the auto industry sort of misreading the situation and thinking that they could just retrofit their gas platforms and turn them into electric cars and that people would want to buy them, and that sort of proposition being far too expensive for most people. And then also, obviously, the sort of the politicization, Trump running on a platform of eliminating electric vehicle incentives and then obviously following through on that.
Yeah, Jessica, could you jump in on that? Because we were on this trajectory where a lot of us thought, you know what, the future was going to be EV in America. We saw the charging stations being built along different highways. And then, boom, the Trump administration takes a shift. Can you talk about how that is impacting the market and what you're seeing among automakers in the industry in America? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the acceptance for the American public for EVs is very different depending on where you are. So I think that's the other big part of this story, is that in some places in the United States, maybe EVs are not the practical decision for a lot of people in 2026. You know, the infrastructure just not being there. So in urban areas, make total sense. Maybe in areas like West Texas or the Dakotas or any of those places, a little bit tougher. So I think that trying to sort of, I guess, satisfy the entire country with one strategy is a bit tough. And that's why I think we're seeing some of the resurgence from hybrids. Toyota has been really great at that. There was a caller earlier that had a Toyota Camry hybrid paying too much for it. Well, she's paying too much for it because the demand is extremely high for that vehicle. And it seems like the American automakers now have pivoted and thinking more about what they can do in the hybrid as sort of the bridge strategy, because the way that the American public has looked at the adoption of electric vehicles has been different from other countries. And we do require, you know, more things like range and, you know, reason why some of the Chinese EVs are cheaper, because they, you know, they have more limited range, whereas that's probably not going to work in the US. Mm. We love to buy cars with the goal of we're going to go on this very long car trip and the vehicle has to be able to go the entire way. It's just, we may never do that car trip, but it is something that is ingrained in our brains and it comes up so often when people purchase vehicles. So it's just a bit of a different psyche in the way we were approaching it.
According to Morgan Stanley, China's battery electric market is 7 times larger than the U.S., with the lead widening every year. You talked about some of the reasons, Andrew, on the U.S. side, that maybe the manufacturers didn't approach this problem correctly. Obviously, there's some infrastructure challenges in America. And like Jessica mentioned, there's also just different transportation needs in America. But let's look at the China side of the equation. What did the government do there? And is it all stuff that's replicable here in America? Because obviously the government there, the way it interacts with industry is very different. There's also widespread labor practices in China that are probably not going to be replicated here in America. So what did China do to establish that dominance and also give us a sense of like what type of EVs are available in China and how much they cost?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to supply chain, specifically around electric vehicle batteries. And that's something that China recognized really early on that it wanted to control. And if it did, it could dictate sort of how cheap it could make these vehicles. And it really, I think, did a phenomenal job in cornering the battery market. I think you see now that, you know, most of the major battery manufacturers are in China. Not only that, but the refinement of the minerals and the components that go into the batteries are all done in that country as well. And that has really allowed them to not only reduce the cost of the electric vehicles that they sell in their companies sell, but also sort of, you know, drive prices around the world, because it's not just China that needs these batteries. It's also Europe. It's the Americas. It's everywhere that is shifting over to electric vehicles. So I think that, in addition to the companies that are in China, there are many of them. It is the largest auto market in the world. There are hundreds of brands. It's really kind of insane how many vehicle brands there are in China.
And how much can you get like a sedan for what? $20,000, $25,000? Like what's the price point for an EV sedan in China, or like a leading model?
So if you take BYD, for example, BYD is the leading manufacturer in China. They offer, I think, 10 models that are priced below the Tesla Model 3, which is, I think, one of the cheapest models, electric vehicles, new electric vehicles that you can buy in the United States.
Wow.
They have...
what's that price point?
Some of their lowest, in U.S. dollars, some of their lowest price models are around $10,000 to $12,000.
Wow, wow, wow.
And these are very, very simple electric vehicles. I think Jessica's right. They don't have a lot of range. They don't have a lot of features, but they are incredibly affordable to most people in the country, which is why you're seeing such a strong shift over to electric vehicles in that country.
So interesting. Let's bring in a couple callers because we got a lot of people on the line. We have Barbara from Chester County on the line. Barbara, you're on Studio 2. What's your take on the car buying experience?
Well, we at the end of 2024, we bought a Hyundai Ioniq 6, this little sedan absolutely loved. And the end of last year, we bought a Camry, 2026 Camry, obviously hybrid because that's all they make now. So,
yeah, good experience. You got good experience.
Great experience.
Okay.
Great experience. The one thing I will say about we put a charger in for our electric car, but one of the surprises I got was when we went to renew our registration with like a $200 registration, but I normally pay like $40 for a car, and basically across the U.S. because electric cars are not using gas and they. Roadways are being kept up through our gas taxes, they slap electric cars with much higher registration fees.
Wow. Little surprise there, yeah. Barbara from Chester County.
That you don't know. Well, it's not
just
Chester County, it's the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah. We're just saying you're from Chester County.
Let's bring in Mary from Bethlehem, by the way. Hey, Mary, you're on Studio 2. I think you wanted to talk about a good old reliable car. Mary, you're on Studio 2. What's your story?
Yeah, hi, guys. Nice to talk to you, too. I had a still outside, a 1999 Brighton Subaru that I bought. Back then it was $18,000. I leased it for $288,000, and then I bought it. 5 years I leased it, 4 years I paid for it at $244,000. It has 190,000 miles on it. It's about 25, 26 years old, and the guy still has it. And he's still running it. But every time something needed to be done, I did it. I didn't sit around. Wonderful guy that I take it to for 44 years. He lets me pay as I go. So I was able to take care of it and never left me stranded. And now I drive a 2003 Ford Taurus that had 46,000 miles on it.
All right.
Mary keeps her cars. Mary from Bethlehem. Andrew, I wonder, because I think back 100 years, and I think, America used to be this leader when it comes to auto, the automobile, the auto industry across the world. And then, we kind of ceded a lot of ground to, foreign automakers. Do you see sort of, I feel like in the EV market, we're sort of taking another hit, and we're sort of ceding more ground. Do we have lessons in history that we can take from as you see us like sort of letting others get ahead of us when it comes to EVs?
Well, I think that it's important to recognize that while the current situation is cars are getting more expensive, automakers are just de-investing from electric vehicles. A lot of them are still saying that they're committed to developing cheaper EVs for their customers. Ford is right now engaged in a pretty high stakes project to lower the cost of its EVs. They said that they're going to have a $30,000 electric truck to sell starting in 2027. GM as well has said that it's trying to lower the price of its EVs. You're seeing some new startups come on the market that are sort of taking the Tesla playbook and trying to replicate that, but for cheaper EVs. There does still seem to be some activity in the industry around trying to sort of crack the code and replicate what China has shown as a very successful formula. But that said, I do think that the story can be told by, if you look at the earnings reports from these companies, and they're just writing off billions of dollars from these investments based on, you know, sort of the disappearance of all of these EV incentives. And now, obviously, a lack of any sort of fuel regulation and emissions regulations at all. So that I think that's going to have a significant impact on the future. And if America is the country that is still sort of plodding along in these gas driven vehicles while the rest of the world is going electric, you know, I'm not sure what that says about sort of our place on the world stage when it comes to leaders.
Real quick, though, just in the competition with China specifically, because in the past there were Korean and Japanese manufacturers that came in and undercut the big three here in this country. Those are very different societies than China, right? How much is the Chinese government's thumb on the scale still when it comes to the development of batteries and EVs? And is that something that could possibly even be replicated here? Or are we always going to be like playing at a disadvantage here, Andrew?
Yeah, that's certainly a big concern. You hear it from policymakers as they talk about this issue, wondering why, you know, why this is, why we are not allowing China to import vehicles to the United States, because there's such a concern about the government's involvement in the industry, surveillance activity, cybersecurity concerns when it comes to the companies that collect data from these vehicles. So there's still a lot of hurdles that China would need to overcome in order to import their vehicles here. It's essentially impossible today. But as you noted, we allow, you know, Korean companies, Japanese companies to import their vehicles to the United States. It stands to reason that eventually China will be able to import their EVs to America, and at which point I think a lot of the domestic the big three, Detroit's big three, needs to have their situation under control by that point, because if it comes in and all of a sudden, you know, people are presented with the opportunity to buy a $10,000 Chinese electric vehicle, they're going to start looking at, you know, the $70,000 and $80,000 F-150s and Chevy trucks a lot differently, I think. So I do think that there is a lot of danger if automakers, especially American automakers, continue on the path of just prioritizing gas vehicles and try to sort of just ignore the fact that the rest of the world is going.
Jessica, do you agree? Do you think that the EV revolution is inevitable, even if we drag our feet in this country, that at some point down the line, whether it's 20, 50, 75 years, we are going to go electric? And at that point, whoever's got the batteries is going to be kind of in charge of the game. Do you agree with that, or is it more nuanced? What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I think eventually that is the end goal, and even the American automakers have admitted themselves. And I mean, I will say that, I mean, we've been pretty hard about on the U.S. this whole conversation, but all of the technology is developed here in the U.S. It is scaled in China. They are masters at that. We all know that. Yep. So when we think about that, the road ahead, I think, for the American automakers specifically, and everyone that is tangential to the electrification, is looking at maybe where is the tech going? It's not always going to be at the point it is now. And maybe we get ahead of that curve instead. And that's sort of how we kind of regain a more prominent position and not just let, you know, the Chinese automakers sort of overtake, you know, everything.
Yeah.
Let's try to squeeze in one more caller. We have Jim from South Jersey on the line. Jim, you're on Studio 2. What's your take on a car buying experience? Or you might have a question here?
No, just a point of view.
Okay.
Two things. First of all, this country is, that the leadership of this country is not really promoting electric vehicles, they're promoting fossil fuels. That's one issue, but that's not the whole issue. If you go anywhere in this world today, electric vehicles are proliferating, either hybrid or total electric, because the government, number one, says that they're not going to let gasoline prices drop below a certain level. So if you go to Italy, you know, it's $8 a liter. I mean, they're not going to allow gasoline to get to the point where people are going to buy 10-mile-a-gallon cars. So we're a competitive society. So my point is this. Gas prices, I mean, there's a lot of subsidies that go on, I believe, in the oil industry, but gas prices are way too low. And people are not going to they're not incentivized to buy anything that's going to be fuel efficient. You see, you know, these trucks run all over the place because it's cheaper than spring water. And if gas is cheaper than spring water, then you're buying Wawa, you're going to keep your gasoline car.
Jim, Jessica has something to say on that. Thank you.
Well,
I used to work in Cherry Hill and lived in Philadelphia. You know what? Your gas prices are cheap. I live in California now. It's not unusual to pay $6 a gallon here. So it's not everywhere that gas prices are quite as low as they are. And that's why you see more electric vehicles sold in California, because gas prices are much higher here because of our taxes and some of the special blends that the roads require here.
So I wonder, as we close out, sort of what will it take to sort of, if you were to sort of predict, you know, America sort of bringing back the inexpensive car, America sort of innovating and bringing, you know, making EVs like the priority, what will it take to get us there? Jessica and then Andrew, as we get ready to wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, automakers know that cars are expensive, but I think they still need to deliver in packages that people want. We do not want a subcompact car. And I know we had a caller talking about a great smart car. It's not what the majority of people want. And even in other countries, you go to Europe, Australia, cars are much bigger than a lot of people think they are. A lot of SUVs are very prevalent there as well. So if you can deliver in a package that Americans want, a small SUV with flexible cargo space, a little bit more room, sits up higher at a good price, and then an EV version as well, that probably is the formula that's going to work the best here. And again, that's for just like a mass market. Yeah. People obviously have their personal preferences.
And Andrew, you have about 30 seconds, your thoughts.
Yeah, I think a lot of automakers now are sort of trying to replicate the sort of the flexibility and the nimbleness of like tech companies in Silicon Valley, which is why you're seeing like them opening R&D labs and trying to figure out how to like tweak the aerodynamicness of their designs and how to like slim down the batteries and different chemistries. So there is a lot of work that's being done around trying to make these cars cheaper. And I think that they stand a pretty good chance of succeeding given their past record around a lot of this technology. So I do think that there's a positive outlook that to have.
That's Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at The Verge. We also heard from Jessica Caldwell, head of insights at Edmunds. Thank you both for all of your perspective this hour. Let me read this comment quick from Sam, who bought a 2012 Toyota RAV4 2 years ago named Ghost.
Ooh, good
name. Says she's great. Four-wheel drive is absolutely necessary in my area. A lot of electrics didn't have that. Also, parts are cheaper and widely accessible. Plus, she looks like crap, so she's never been broken into. Thanks, Ghost. And thank you for that comment, Sam.
Shout out to Ghost.
Shout out to Ghost. Our car was named Wilma growing up.
Yeah, that's really cool. By the way, sorry, Tim from New Jersey, that we couldn't get to your call, but hopefully you'll try again on another show. And of course, we got to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 here at WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. We're ghosting. We're out.